Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Timothy Beal, the Florence Harkness Professor of Religion at Case Western Reserve University and author of The Rise and Fall of the Bible, The Unexpected History of an Accidental Book, and Biblical Literacy, Essential Bible Stories Everyone Needs to Know. Dr. Beal's appearance was sponsored by the Creighton University Kripke Center for the Study of Religion and Society. To celebrate the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible, he will speak on the topic From the King James Bible to Bible Zines, The History of a Cultural Icon. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday afternoon, November 2, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Ron Simpkins, the director of the Kripke Center for the Study of Religion and Society.
Today's talk is by Professor Timothy Beal, who is the Florence Harkins Professor of Religion at Case Western Reserve University. He's done a number of things, including being most recently editor-in-chief of the Oxford Encyclopedia of the Bible and the Arts, which is currently still in production. And he's published 13 books, many scholarly articles on the topics of the cultural history of the Bible, religion and popular culture, and relations between critical theory and academic religious culture. Some of his noteworthy books, ones that probably are most interesting in this group, would be Biblical Literacy, The Essential Bible Stories Everyone Needs to Know, Religion in America, a very short introduction, Roadside Religion, In Search of the Sacred, the Strange, and the Substance of Faith, and one that I haven't read, but its title is intriguing, Religion and Its Monsters, among many other books. Most recently, just this past spring, he has published The Rise and Fall of the Bible, The Unexpected History of an Accidental Book. I remember the day last spring that the book was published because I bought it. I immediately purchased it, downloaded it onto my iPad, and within literally, I think, 2 days, I consumed the whole thing. Well, it would perhaps be too much hyperbole to say that this book transformed my life, Alterly shaking the way I see the world, but I do have to say that it has shaped my thinking in significant ways. It has raised to me the consciousness of what is Bible, a question I had not quite considered, which is a little bit ironic, considering I spend my whole life studying and working in the Bible. But he raised it in new and interesting ways. Rarely does one read a scholarly book with such freshness, clarity, and insight as this book. He's published many essays on religion and culture in the popular press for the New York Times, the Chronicle of Higher Education, on CNN.com, and many on the Huffington Post. He's been featured on national radio shows, including NPR's All Things Considered, The Bob Edwards Show, WUBR's On Point, and Interfaith Voices. Tim was with us at a conference a couple years ago in Omaha, and that was the first time I had met him and heard him. And it was to a crowd that was just kind of awed by his presentation, I have to say. It's clear, it's concise, and it kind of shapes the way you might see things from then on. So it's with great delight that I'm able to introduce Timothy Beal, and I think you're in for a nice treat. So please help me welcome him.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Ron, for that really generous introduction. It means a lot to me, coming from such a great scholar and teacher. And thanks to Creighton University and to the Kripke Center for the Study of Religion and Society. Great to be here and to participate with you all. It's good to be back. 2011 is almost over, not to freak you out too much about upcoming finals and things like that that'll come before then, but you might be worried that we're getting a little close to the end of the 400th anniversary. You know, the King James Bible was first published in 1611, and you almost missed it. You might feel that way, and a lot of the celebrations this summer were around May. I think they decided that was going to be the official day to celebrate the 400th anniversary, the 400th birthday of the King James Version Bible. But in fact, nobody knows exactly when the King James Version Bible was first published. They, for some reason, it wasn't momentous enough to have recorded it in the typical registry, like the copyright in publication data kind of thing. And so there is no actual date in 1611 for its publication. What we know is that it had to have been published by this month, November, because there is a diary entry. I've never seen it, but from what I understand, there's a diary entry that mentions having acquired a King James, an authorized version Bible in the month of November. So you're actually just perfectly right on time. Yeah. Anyway, good to be here. And what I'd like to talk with you about, the topic is From the King James Bible to Bible Zines, the History of a Cultural Icon. And I really want to know how we got from here. This is the front cover page of a King James Bible from 1611 to here. This is another Bible, one of many Bible zines, this one marketed to young women, kind of Marie Claire in style audience, I guess you could say, a New Testament version in this particular case. So how we got from here to here is really the question, to try to connect these dots in the history of the Bible and maybe add a few dots in between to make it make a little more sense. And I think that in the process of reflecting on this, we might come to see how these two Bibles, this one and this one, are not so unrelated as they might initially appear. And it seems to me that the King James Version's 400th anniversary is a good opportunity for us not only to reflect on that earlier revolutionary publication and why it's still around and where it's going next, but also on what's happening to the Bible now. I think that we're in the midst of a kind of media revolution in the history of the Bible, a cultural revolution in the history of the Bible that will be as big as the invention of the printing press and the rise of print book culture many centuries ago. And it's going to change the way we think about the Bible. It's going to change our cultural ideas of the Bible and the way we interact with it and so on. And think about it. The book that Ron mentioned, The Rise and Fall of the Bible, the original title for that was The End of the Word as We Know It. But my publisher said I couldn't use that title because she thought that too many buyers at Barnes & Noble retailer places and stuff like that would worry that people would miss the missing L and just think it's another book called The End of the World as We Know It, and so pass it by. So, but that's really my argument in that book, is that it's the end of the word as we know it. That's kind of my diagnosis of what's going on in the history of the Bible, that the way we have known for some time now the Bible, our sort of cultural idea of the Bible, is going away. It's very much tied to book culture, and our idea of the Bible is very much tied to our idea of the print book and so on. I think that the King James Version Bible is very much tied to that as well. So the other half of that book really is the other half of the REM song that I'm kind of quoting, sort of, you know, that song, It's the End of the World as We Know It, in the chorus, and what's the next part? And I feel fine. That's my sort of religious response to the end of the word as we know it. I see it as an opportunity to reimagine the Bible and rediscover the Bible in a way that's truer to its history, to its media history, and truer to its contents as well, not as a book of answers, but as a library of questions, and not as a rock, but as a river, always changing. So that's the context, and what I'll do is I'll talk a little bit and read a little bit and look forward to some time for some conversation and some back and forth with you all and see where that gets us. The subtitle, as I mentioned earlier, is The History of a Cultural Icon. So I'd like to start there with what I mean when I say cultural icon. What do I mean when I say that the Bible is a cultural icon? What is the cultural icon of the Bible? So a cultural icon is different from a traditional icon. A traditional icon is a particular material object that is believed to mediate a transcendent reality. That's a kind of standard definition of an icon. And its power to do so is created and maintained by the various rituals people practice in relation to it. So an example might be of an iconic Bible, not a culturally iconic Bible, might be the Bible used to swear in a new president. For example, Obama using Lincoln's Bible in his inauguration. Or a handwritten Torah scroll presented to a congregation in a synagogue. A cultural icon, on the other hand, is not so concrete. It is not tied to a particular material object, visual image, or ritual practice. Its outlines are a little vague, hard to define sharply. And it's really kind of a condensation of what people who identify with it believe in and value. It says something about the culture in which it holds its iconic value. So we look at cultural icons in order to understand culture. What does this say as a kind of symptom of culture, about our culture? So the American flag is a cultural icon of patriotism. A four-wheel drive truck is a cultural icon of American independence, toughness, and most of all, masculinity. So what do I mean when I say the Bible as a cultural icon? What is the cultural iconicity or the iconic meaning of the Bible in our popular culture? This is the Hot Rodder's Bible and the Shooter's Bible. The Shooter's Bible is actually one of the earliest books that was the something Bible. I think it started back in the 1940s as the Shooter's Bible, with no Bible verses in it or anything like that. Now we have thousands and thousands of the so-and-so's Bible, right? Curtain maker's Bible, bartender's Bible, skier's Bible, fly fisherman's Bible, and so on. So one way to explicate the general kind of cultural iconicity of the Bible in mass culture is to consider the many hundreds of instruction books and manuals that are called Bibles, from the bartender's Bible to the curtain Bible to the small game and varmint hunter's Bible to the classic shooter's Bible. What does it mean to call something the Bible? What does this title claim for a book? What does it promise? What is the cultural meaning, in other words, of the Bible that a publisher claims when it publishes something like the Hot Rodder's Bible? What are the iconic cultural attributes of the Bible, in quotes, that these books claim? That is to say, what does the Bible mean culturally? I think, first of all, it means I have six attributes, I guess you can say. And I know that has to be wrong, because it has to either be three or seven, but I have six. So either too many or one short. It's an imperfect list, I guess. First of all, it means authoritative. A book that is called the Bible claims to be the ultimate authority. It is the Alpha and the Omega, the first and last word on its particular subject. Second, it means univocal, one-voiced. A book called the Bible speaks for itself in one unified voice without contradiction. It means, third, practical. A book called the Bible promises to serve as a reference manual and a dependable guide for how to proceed along the path its reader has chosen. Fourth, it means accessible. A book called the Bible promises to speak to anyone and everyone clearly and simply, without ambiguity, in terms, quote, on the back of a lot of these, even I can understand, right? Fifth, it means comprehensive. A book called the Bible claims to cover everything human beings may ever possibly need to know about its subject, past, present, and future. Sixth and finally, it means exclusive. A book called the Bible admits no rivals, no alternative perspectives. It is complete unto itself, closed, self-contained within a single book, A to Z, Alpha to Omega, Genesis to Revelation. Nothing may be added or taken away. This, I think, in a nutshell, is the iconic meaning of the Bible. These six different attributes are what we mean when we say the Bible in our popular culture. It's what publishers claim for any book that they're calling the Bible. The Bible, as cultural icon, is the capital B book of all lowercase b books, the book of books, the book of all books, the authoritative, authorial, univocal, comprehensible, final, graspable, and readable Word of God. It is the perfect book by the perfect author, the ultimate image of divine authority, and therefore religion as divinely authored black and white certainty, set and proofed, clean and free of errors. As such, it stands for faith as black and white certainty and religion as right and wrong morality. I'm just describing, I'm diagnosing the cultural meaning of the Bible. That's not really the way I think of it, and probably not really the way your professors of biblical literature do either. But nearly all Americans are familiar with this iconic meaning of the Bible, and in fact, most Americans seem to endorse it. So, for example, the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life found that 78% of all Americans agree with the statement that the Bible is the Word of God. And about half of those 78% of Americans agree with the statement that it should be taken literally, word for word, as the Word of God. There's another polling organization called the Barna Group that does a lot of research for evangelical publishers and so forth. They found that nearly half of all Americans agree with the statement that the Bible is totally accurate in all of its teachings. And 88% of all people who describe themselves as born-again Christians believe that. And then finally, the Gallup poll found that 65% of Americans believe the statement, agree with the statement that the Bible answers all or most of the basic questions of life. And I think these statements are really shorthand descriptions, kind of nutshell descriptions of this iconic idea of the Bible that I just laid out, this idea of the Bible as sort of God's magnum opus, right? And just to foreshadow, we're going to come around to this a little bit later, but this iconic meaning is also what Bible publishers are selling. There is this cultural expectation and desire for that book of books, right? Practical, comprehensive, everything you need to know, whether it's how to ask someone out on a date or get a job or die, right? Everything. And that's what Bible publishers know that we want, and that's what they're promising again and again and again and again with all of these different Bibles they're selling. We'll get to that in a minute. But let's now focus on the King James Version Bible, which if the Bible is God's magnum opus, this is sort of the magnum opus of God's magnum opus in some sense. A couple quotes that give maybe a little bit of a flavor of most of the celebrations of the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible, which have suggested really that it's timeless. It's going to last forever. It has triumphed so far, and it always will. So lines like "Sacred or sublime, the King James Bible is a timeless source," and from the New York Times, "Why the King James Bible endures." That timelessness and enduring influence has been the key theme. This is a timeline. It's pretty much inaccurate in every single one of its time points, but what's significant about it, it's on a website that facilitates King James Bible 400th anniversary celebrations, and I think it starts with the Ten Commandments. I'm not so sure my colleagues in Old Testament would agree that those were written on stone in 1400 BC, and moves all the way through and culminates, of course, at the end of time in 1611 with the King James Bible. So there you have it. That's the end of the story, the culmination and pinnacle of the story as well. So 400 years since the King's printer published the first edition in 1611, the King James Version Bible continues to reign supreme. Not only is it by far the best-selling translation of all time, with more than 5 billion copies sold, I'm told, it is the very icon of Bibleness, the book of books, the premier image of the printed and bound word. Indeed, many assume it's the only Bible. I've never read the Bible, people tell me, because I can't stand all those these and thous. Well, the only Bible that has these and thous in it, pretty much, besides some other old ones that I'm sure they've never seen, is the King James Version Bible, despite the fact that no modern translations have all these and thous. And whether anybody actually ever seriously said, if it was good enough for St. Paul, then it's good enough for me, I think probably a lot of people have thought that. The King James Bible's 400th may well be its biggest birthday ever. But also, I think, this is what I want to suggest anyway, its most poignant birthday ever. Because I think its end draws nigh. Sure, it'll hang around for a while longer, mostly in hotels and old folks' homes. But it's not long for this world, at least in any form we'd recognize from the bookish years of its youth. Often touted as the purest and holiest of all English Bibles, the King James Bible was itself born of political and religious turmoil. King James I commissioned it as a counter-revolutionary alternative to the very popular Geneva Bible, which had been published in 1560 by Puritan exiles in Switzerland. Harshly critical of the English monarchy, their translation and especially their marginal commentary often had a subversive edge. In Exodus, for example, when the midwives didn't follow Pharaoh's order to kill the Hebrew males as soon as they were born, you remember that story, a marginal note from the translators says that they were right to disobey the unjust law, but wrong to do so secretly. Now remember, this is a bunch of Puritan exiles who have openly rebelled and have suffered as a result, saying it's right to disobey because it's an unjust law. Civil disobedience is right, but they should have done that openly. When Pharaoh next orders that all Hebrew boys be tossed into the Nile, this note adds, when tyrants cannot prevail by craft, they brast forth into open rage. Brast is it's the same as burst. So no wonder King James I declared such notes, and this is a quote from him, seditious and savoring too much of dangerous and traitorous conceits. And no surprise that his rival, the King James Bible, as we now call it, prohibited any notes or illustrations and strictly regulated who was authorized to publish it and how. Thus it became known as the Authorized Bible, the Authorized Version. I think many of us assume that that was pretty much the end of the story, that King James I had effectively closed the book on the Bible, that his authorized version quickly established itself as the one and only English Bible, that it was basically crowned in 1611 and has been sitting on the throne ever since to this day, to use a biblical expression. Unauthorized, and yet that's not actually true at all. Unauthorized yet ambitious printers soon found profitable ways around the government's control on Bible publishing. It's fascinating looking into the history of this, just the business operations and the competition to make money off of this new text and republish it in different ways. Some purchased Bibles published by authorized printers took them apart and inserted illustrations and other value-adding content like maps and illustrations into it, and then rebound and resold it at higher costs. Some sold these as commentaries, books that happened to include all or nearly all of the King James Bible's text, but then also added some comments here or there, so it was not actually the authorized Bible anymore. It was a commentary on the Bible, even though it really included the whole biblical text as well. Some radically abridged the text of the King James Bible to make portable editions, like the 16-page Soldier's Pocket Bible. This was published in 1643, I can read some of it, I think, to you. The Soldier's Pocket Bible, containing the most, if not all, those places contained in Holy Scripture which do show the qualifications of his inner man, that is the soldier's inner man, that is a fit soldier to fight the Lord's battles, both for the fight in for before he fight, in the fight, and after the fight, which scriptures are reduced to several heads and fitly applied to the soldier's several occasions, and so may supply the want of the whole Bible, which a soldier cannot conveniently carry about him, and may be also useful for any Christian to meditate upon now in this miserable time of war. So there is already in 1643, very shortly after the publication of the King James Bible, we've got this highly abridged 16-page long Bible that is the King James Bible in some sense. Other publishers completely reshuffled the contents of the King James Bible, and the most dramatic one of these was Matthew. Oh, I meant to point out this other one next to it here. This one is another version of a highly abridged early Bible published in 1689. It's called Solomon's Proverbs, and basically what the publisher did was took out all of the Book of Proverbs and the Book of Ecclesiastes and reshuffled all of the verses in it into a different order based on topics, and then published it in this form. Again, that's the King James Version Bible in some sense. This one is really interesting. Matthew Talbot's Bible, this was published in 1800. He took all of the verses of the Old and New Testaments out of their original contexts and put them into 30 new topical books. And I have the 30 books include the Book of Lawless Love. So he takes all of the verses out that have something to do with lawless love and organizes them. There's one called the Book of the Deity as well. So various topics like that, all completely reshuffled. And all the entire Bible is there, but completely reshuffled and reorganized thematically. Still others imported King James and Geneva Bibles printed in other countries, often underselling the authorized printers who protested that they lacked quality control and were full of misprints. So the king's printers, who had control of publishing the King James Version Bible in England, would complain that these guys publishing Bibles in Amsterdam didn't have good quality controls. Actually, what we know is that the quality was oftentimes better for those that were published out of country, especially of the Geneva Bibles that were published out of country. But they would complain about the quality. In an imported Bible from 1682, for example, a passage about divorce addresses a situation in which a husband ate rather than hate his wife. So it's if a husband hate his wife, he may divorce her kind of a thing. But it said if a husband ate his wife, he may divorce her. But such protests were undermined by the errors that were in King's printer Bibles. This is a verse from the so-called Wicked Bible. It's not what the publisher called it, but it came to be known as that. It was published in 1631, I believe. Yeah, 1631, and forgot a rather significant knot in the seventh commandment, so that instead of saying, thou shalt not commit adultery, it says, thou shalt commit adultery. Hey, it's in the Bible. Interesting little side note, you remember I mentioned that the marginal notes and so forth that seem sort of anti-monarchy in the Geneva Bible, they were still very, very popular, and so what started happening after about 1640 or so, and all the way up into the early 1700s, they started publishing King James translation Bibles with the marginal notes from the Geneva Bible entered into them. So you had these King James Bibles with the Geneva Bible's marginal notes. So all kinds of different things being published still. We tend to think that the printing press led to a standardization of the Bible, and that the King James Version was the culmination of that process. Indeed, the King James Bible stands in our cultural imaginary for the immortality of the book. It represents the transcendent immutability of the printed word. Yet the reality of the Bible in the age of print, including publishing of the King James Version, has been quite the opposite. A flood of biblical proportions covering the world in more Bibles, in more forms and contents than ever. Already by 1800, at least 1,000 different editions of the Bible in English had been published. And you saw some examples. It wasn't just all the same Bible, different editions. There was a lot of variety there, not in, only in terms of physical form, but in terms of content and so forth as well. Over the next two centuries, the number and variety grew exponentially to the point that by the 1970s, the American Bible Society in New York gave up trying to collect every new edition of the Bible in English, which was a wise decision because since then the Bible publishers have kind of pulled out all the stops. So they gave up in the 70s, but Bible publishing has actually gone absolutely crazy since then. These are just a few examples of King James Version Bibles, the King James Bible, if you will. My favorite is right in the middle there, and that is a waterproof Bible for rafts and lifeboats that was published in during World War II. And so you didn't have plastic wrapper, so to speak. So these are, they're wrapped in foil and wax paper, and they were kept on lifeboats. So when a ship went down, there would be a Bible, and they had interreligious ones that had the Psalms, and they had Protestant ones, and they had Catholic ones, and the American Bible Society actually has a couple that are still unopened in their collection. But lots of different King James Bibles, as you can see, and we saw some earlier ones as well. Now let's move ahead and look at Bible publishing today. Lots and lots of new Bibles being published. And again, every kind of physical form and visual format and every kind of contents as well. Because the notes and the commentary and all of those kinds of things are part of what the Bible is in every particular instance, right? How many of you familiar with the Way Bible? Okay. Yeah, me, I grew up with one, published in 1974, I believe, the full version. This was a collaboration between editors of Campus Life magazine, which was a kind of trendy, make Christianity cool for high school kids kind of a movement that my parents were leaders of, so I can kind of characterize it in that way. I grew up a Campus Life leader's kid, but it was a collaboration between the magazine editors of Campus Life magazine who were thinking about layout and attracting and making popular and all of that kind of stuff and, imitating other popular magazines in the kind of media work they were doing, and Tyndale House, which was a Bible publisher that had only just started by publishing the Living Bible. The Living Bible was a translation, so to speak, more of a paraphrase of the American Standard Bible done by Kenneth Taylor. And he couldn't get it published by an existing publisher, so he ended up publishing it himself and started Tyndale House that way. It was the best-selling book on the New York Times list under nonfiction for two consecutive years. Anyway, this was a collaboration between these magazine editors and Tyndale House and the Living Bible. And so it's kind of magazine-y. It looks like a Doobie Brothers album cover, the way they lay it out, and it has all these pictures inside of cool kind of, stringy-haired kids holding hands and thinking about social injustice and love, of course, and playing guitars and all of that kind of stuff. And there were these nice introductions written by the editors of the magazine that were very engaging. And so you could look at the this was my experience reading the Bible, that Bible, looking at the pictures and reading the introductions by the magazine editors and that kind of thing. But it was really a breakout book. It published 4.3 million copies. It was a nonprofit venture, so they didn't make any money off of it. But it kind of signaled to the Christian publishing world, there's gold in them there hills. And in the wake of that, we've seen this just explosion of Bible publishing going on. So that this year, about 6,000 different editions of the Bible will be published in English alone, representing an incredibly wide variety of things and contents, from nostalgically appealing zippered, leather-bound Bibles and family Bibles to chronological Bibles in which all of the verses have been rearranged into someone's idea of biblical history. And we might think that sounds novel, but we saw Talbot's Bible from 1800, which isn't so different, to graphic novel-style manga Bibles, to R. Crumb's Genesis Illustrated. Some of you may know that. Pretty interesting. To the brick Bible, brick Testament. I just saw that the guy who's been making a Bible out of Legos for about 10 years now has published a book that's like comic book layout of his different scenes of the Bible. Interesting. To niche marketed Bibles like the Golfer's Bible, the Bride's Bible, to, of course, Bible zines. And here we are. Biblical magazines that are designed to target different age groups and genders, like Real, which is some kind of a hip-hop generation kind of thing. It says, "How Ya Travelin'" there under it, and it comes with a hip-hop, Christian hip-hop CD. Magnify, which is obviously for the Nickelodeon Channel generation or something like that. Becoming, I talked about earlier, kind of in-style Marie Claire, sort of Jennifer Aniston-looking model on the cover. If you can read some of the lines. Men, the inside scoop. Your life, what's the point? The must-have for your wardrobe. And then over here, a line which is obviously for professional men, I guess you could say. I like that he's barefoot in a suit. But or a tie anyway. Success, S-E-X-C-E-S-S, success with the opposite sex. Improve your people skills and win. Learn to prosper without cutting corners. Top 10 lists for getting ahead. Got gadgets, 34 tech-savvy ideas, and it goes on like that. Each of these is the Bible, if you will. Most of them are the complete New Testament, much like what we have out front here. They include all of the text of the Christian New Testament. Some of them include other portions of biblical material. The thing that's interesting about them is that they have all these really splashy call-outs and images and visuals and how-tos about gadgets and success and so forth. The biblical text is in a rather sort of bookish-looking font, very small, lots of columns, and it really kind of looks like background, like wallpaper on a website or something like that, right? It's really not what people are reading when they're reading the Bible in this particular case. I particularly like this one, Refuel, which is for teenage boys. And, of course, instead of the New Testament, it includes all of the biblical war story material from Joshua and Judges and 1 and 2 Kings and so on like that. And so titles on this one include 70 Ways to Live Out Radical Faith, The Best in Books and Music, Men of the Sword, How Unstoppable Warriors Got So Awesome. I love that one. Cool stuff lists. There are things in there like, you know, how to talk to your biology professor about intelligent design or creationism versus evolution, and how to ask girls out on dates and all of that. The things that, you know, maybe a 14-year-old boy thinks, if the Bible is supposed to give me answers to what matters to me in my life, well, that's the kind of stuff I care about as a 14-year-old boy, right? So the Bible should speak to me, you know, in a direct, clear way with clear answers. And so that's really, you know, give the people what they want. That's what this this is doing, more than most people's experience of just reading biblical text. This is a great page from Refuel. It's the story of Saul's death in the background there, but you kind of get a feel for the layout. And it says, how to grill the perfect steak. is the big headline at the top of it, which I suppose, you know, maybe in another day, 40 years ago, it would have been how to dress out a deer or something like that. But now it is like grilling. That's how to be a man, right? So it makes sense that it would be in the Bible for teen boys who want to grow up to be men and grill perfect steaks. These newfangled Bibles include volumes of value-adding and values-adding notes and comments, and they come in dozens and dozens of translations, including non-copyrighted texts like the King James Version, as well as a growing number of proprietary translations, most notably the New King James Version from evangelical publishing behemoth Thomas Nelson. This has just enough of that kind of King Jamesian sort of flavor of English, but they've clarified it a little bit as well. And then, so they've basically drafted on that the power of the King James Version Bible and gotten some value out of that brand, if you will. But at the same time, they've ended up creating a proprietary translation. So they've used a non-copyrighted translation, the King James Version, to create a slightly altered copyrighted translation that now they control, and that has a pretty big pie slice of the market in translations. All these widely divergent things and contents will be sold as the Bible. No king or anyone else can restrict extensions, revisions, and reinventions of the Bible. And so it will continue ad infinitum, biblical liquidation. The larger setting in which this biblical fire sale is happening is, of course, the twilight of print culture and the dawning of the digital revolution. Traditional print books are rapidly losing ground as the dominant medium for reading and writing. Doesn't mean they're going away, but they're rapidly losing ground as the dominant medium for the ways we encounter text and writing and reading. How will the way we think about, read, and share the Bible change in the emerging networked digital media culture in which everything is editable, movable, cut, copy, and pastable, mash-upable, and in which the lines between inside and outside, canonical and non-canonical, are fuzzy and permeable? The decline of print culture and the rise of digital network culture means the end of the book as we know it. And the end of the book as we know it will be the end of the Word, the book of books as we know it, and, I think, of its flagship, the King James Version. Today, as we gather around to sing Happy Birthday to Old King James, it's less about celebrating the eternal triumph of the printed word and more about nostalgia for earlier days. We are aware more than ever before of good old King James Bible's mortality, that it too shall pass and go the way of all Bibles. James' phrase, go the way of all flesh, right? I was kind of proud of that one. Indeed, we are aware more or less consciously that the idea of the Bible that it has represented for so long, the authorized and authoritative word printed and bound and fixed for all time, was an illusion. The King James Bible's seeming steadfastness as the cultural icon of the word without end hides the actual historical reality of biblical impermanence, but it's now on cultural life support, and the writing is on the wall. No doubt, here in the twilight years of book culture, innovative media entrepreneurs will find ways to reanimate the text of the King James Version for a new hypertextual dawn. Some will recoil in horror at their recreations, declaring their monstrous progeny an abomination against God and King. Still others will embrace its post-print resurrections. A Bible believer from my youth, I sympathize with the former and their longing for that old-time religion. Yet I number myself among the latter, seeing this moment as a chance to reimagine the Bible after the Bible. If there's one thing that's constant in the history of the Bible, it's change. The end of the word as we know it will open up other ways of knowing. I'm actually going to... Thank you very much. I'm just going to leave this as a background. These are some examples of the New King James Version Bible. Just to give you, maybe remember the first picture of the old frontispiece from the King James Bible and how could we get from there to the Bible zines? Well, maybe this is something a little bit closer to both, right? This is the New King James Version Bible in various forms. The chronological study Bible that rearranges all of the verses of the Bible into what that historian thinks is chronological order. The American Patriots Bible, which is a very hotly selling Bible these days that basically rearranges and adds commentary and so forth to make the Bible America's book in some sense. God's Promises for Fathers, as well as God's Answers for graduate students, for the graduates of the class of 2012. I thought, you know, if you're looking for a gift for your friends, you know, if that are graduating, you can keep that in mind. Or for your father on Father's Day.
A member of the audience asked for Dr. Beal's comments on what he called the Performed Bible.
When you said the Performed Bible, I thought you were going to talk about liturgy, which is another way of thinking about the Bible. You know, the Bible in the Book of Common Prayer or the Bible in, you know, various liturgical contexts, which are also performed. Live performances of the Gospel of Mark and so forth like that, right? I think that's also the Bible, right? Marshall McLuhan, the great media theorist from the 60s and 70s, he wrote this amazing book that you all should go and read. I've just been rereading it again, called Understanding Media, written in 1968. It's an incredible book because he's basically looking at the radio and the light bulb and the television, and he's kind of describing the internet age. He just has this incredible mind for thinking about how electricity is going to change everything. He describes a medium as an extension of ourselves into the world, which is different from the way I think most of us think about media as, you know, something that just conveys something. But medium as an extension of ourselves into the world, we can think about performance as another medium, right? And we can think about the famous line from Marshall McLuhan is that the medium is the message. You can't separate content from media technology, from medium. They are one and the same, or they're interconnected in ways that we can't separate them out. And I would think a performed Bible is a great example of that. But that is the Bible too, right? And that contributes in various ways or feeds into or challenges our cultural iconic idea of what the Bible is. But I think, too, that there are interesting connections if we think back to early scriptural culture, like maybe during the time of Jesus or well into the second century Common Era in both Judaism and early Christianity, where, you know, no one read to themselves. No one had a book and kept it on their nightstand like a Bible and read it and to themselves and moved around in it. For one, it was a scroll culture, not a book culture, so that's a very different kind of reading. But literacy in that context was about oral performance, and in fact, you canted texts. You basically sung them in a sort of melodic, rhythmic way. So performing the text, and readers would practice and to do that in a worship service or something. So next time you go and you look at chapter 4 of Luke and the story of Jesus standing up in the synagogue, which I believe is the oldest, isn't it the oldest account of a synagogue event that we have in literary history? But when you read that story and Jesus stands up and he's handed the scroll and it's open to the place in Isaiah and he reads, imagine Jesus canting that text, essentially singing that text, because he wouldn't have read it like the guy in The Greatest Story Ever Told or something like that, or like a preacher today. But again, it's back to performance, and there are some ways in which something like that harkens back to pre-book culture, maybe, in some respects. I think it's a great question.
A question was asked as to whether the Douay-Rheims Bible was the papacy's response in 1611 to the King James translation of the Bible.
The Douay-Rheims was finished in like 1609 and 1610, which was too late for, from what I understand, too late to have had much influence on the King James translation. From what I've heard, it was already so far underway by then that it didn't have as much of influence as it otherwise would have. A couple things interesting about that are that it was also done by exiles who had been exiled by Mary Tudor, from what I understand, Catholic exiles in France. So it, like the Geneva Bible, has that history to it. And I'm not sure about the. I don't know if anyone else maybe knows something about that, but that's an interesting question. No, I think it's the New American Bible, right? And the New American Bible just came out with a fairly significant, or is it very significant? I haven't looked at it closely. Fairly significant edition of that translation came out in 2011. Why would that be? Because you want to kind of draft on the enduring steadfastness of the King James Bible, I think. But it's interesting to ask, why didn't it come out in 1610, since that's when the Douay-Rheims came out? But I don't think there was as much fanfare around that. But I think it's the New American Bible. The other Bible that came out in 1611 was the New International Version. There's a New International Version, and which is trying to make every, which is trying to trying to forget the today's New International Version that came out several years ago that tried to use gender inclusive language. New International Version Bible really markets itself mostly to evangelicals, and there was a really negative reaction to the use of inclusive language in the today's New International Version, something that I had commended actually, and so the new International Version goes back away, steps away from today's New International Version, but it too came out in 2011. I would guess that if the New American Bible or the New International Version had been finished in 2006, they would have waited until 2011 to announce it because of that power of drafting off of the King James Version Bible.
A final question asked about the comment, "It's the end of the word as we know it, and I feel fine," or should it be, "I feel depressed"?
Some of it might be the kind of old school Protestant iconoclast in me, but I've thought about that a little bit. One, I don't think we're leaving a cultural context of biblical literacy. We have a cultural, we have a circulating in our cultural, in our culture, an iconic idea of the Bible that has very little to do with what you get when you sit down and try to read biblical texts. And I think actually in some ways that iconic idea gets in the way of people actually reading biblical texts and engaging them. That's my experience as a teacher. Mostly what I do is read texts with students and try to, you know, inspire this idea that the closer you look, the more you see, slowing down and closing in and being open to whatever questions emerge for you in relation to the text, rather than worrying about this iconic idea of what the Bible is supposed to be that doesn't seem to be matching my experience of actually reading it. So I think that disconnect between the cultural idea of the Bible and the actual experience of reading biblical texts is part of what keeps people from engaging biblical literature. It creates a disconnect in them. The numbers on biblical illiteracy are pretty staggering, and they've been pretty terrible for a long time. I mean, they're not going to get any lower because I don't think they can. They can, but so that's part of what I see going on there is this tension between our idea of the Bible, which is tied to book culture and which is tied to a few other things that we could get into, and that this can be that in some ways that cultural idea is in the process of deconstruction. that actually all of these Bibles I was showing you are kind of symptomatic of that. I think you would agree with that, probably. I hear you saying you're overwhelmed, maybe more than depressed. I don't know. I feel overwhelmed, but some react to this, and you can just go on Amazon, for example, and read the consumer reviews of Bible zines and things, and you see this all over the place. A lot of people react very negatively to what's going on. They agree with the diagnosis. It's the end of the word as we know it. They're selling down the Bible, etc. But the reaction is to save the Bible. We've got to get back to that pure Bible before it was kind of adulterated in all of these terrible ways. And as a biblical scholar, what I try to do in the book in the middle section between the "and I feel fine" at the end and the "it's the end of the word" at the beginning is to say, okay, well, let's try to do that. Let's try to save the Bible. Get back to that original, pure, the Bible, the Adam of all Bibles, you know, that have led to this, has led to this, you know, crazy family tree that we have now or whatever. And what we find when we try to do that is that there is no such thing, that there is no the original Bible behind all of this crazy mess. And so I want to explore actually what is, you know, the history of the Bible, the cultural history of the Bible, when we think about it, not only in terms of content and all the variants that are there in terms of literary content, but in terms of media technology, media format, and material form and practices around those and so forth. And you just see variety and change all the way through. And so I think there might be an opportunity for something in a digital network culture, a kind of scriptural culture and engagement that actually does look a little bit like Christianity before the book. Maybe scriptural culture after the book will have some resonances with scriptural culture before the book. Now, the other side of me, the cynical or maybe depressed side of me, has been reading this book by Tim Wu, and I'm just blanking on the name of it. Anybody know about the internet and what's happening now with the internet? And he argues that with every new media revolution, there's this initial democratizing phase, and then the corporations figure out how to control the gateways and the distribution and all of that. And so, you know, my more cynical side wonders whether Thomas Nelson and Zondervan and those publishers will simply find a way through the internet to keep selling that iconic idea of the Bible that's never going to really empower people to access these texts in open, you know, self-reflective ways, but it will rather kind of reify that iconic idea. So I guess I see it as inevitable, and I want to engage in that process with some hope. Thank you for the questions. Great questions.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Timothy Beal, the Florence Harkness Professor of Religion at Case Western Reserve University, and author of The Rise and Fall of the Bible, The Unexpected History of an Accidental Book, and Biblical Literacy, Essential Bible Stories Everyone Needs to Know. Dr. Beal's appearance was sponsored by the Creighton University Kripke Center for the Study of Religion and Society. To celebrate the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible, he spoke on the topic, From the King James Bible to Bible Zines, the History of a Cultural Icon. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday afternoon, November 2nd, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.